odor of burnt meat in the air. What happened to your neck? His face paled a few shades. Your godmother gave me a kiss. Damn, I said. Well put. Are you ready? Ready for what? For court to be held, to be given our gifts. The tenuous hold I had on the power faltered, and I lowered my trembling hand, let go of the tension gently before I lost control of it. The last light flickered and went out, leaving us in a darkness I wouldn't have believed possible. And then the darkness was shattered by light. The spotlights again, shining up on the dais, upon the throne there, and Bianca in her flaming dress upon it. Her mouth and throat and the rounded slopes of her breasts were smeared in streaks of fresh blood. Her lips stained scarlet as she smiled down at the darkness, at the dozens of pairs of glowing eyes in it, gazing up at the dais in adoration, or terror, or lust, or all three. All rise, I whispered, as soft whispers and moans rustled up from out of the darkness around us, not at all human. Vampire court is now in session. Chapter 29. Fear has a lot of flavors and textures. There's a sharp, silver fear that runs like lightning through your arms and legs, galvanizes you into action, power, motion. There's heavy, leaden fear that comes in ingots, piling up in your belly, during the empty hours between midnight and morning, when everything is dark, every problem grows larger, every wound and illness grows worse. And there is coppery fear, drawn tight as the strings of a violin, quavering on one single note that cannot possibly be sustained for a single second longer, but goes on and on and on. The tension before the crash of cymbals, the brassy challenge of the horns, the threatening rumble of the kettle drums. That's the kind of fear I felt. Horrible, clutching tension that left the coppery flavor of blood on my tongue. Fear for the creatures in the darkness around me, for my own weakness, the stolen power the nightmare had torn from me, and fear for those around me, for the folk who didn't have the power I had, for Susan, for Michael, for all the young people now laying in the darkness, drugged and dying, or dead already, too stupid or too reckless to have avoided this night. I knew what these things could do to them. They were predators, vicious destroyers, and they scared the living hell out of me. Fear and anger always come hand in hand. Anger is my hiding place from fear, my shield and my sword against it. I waited for the anger to harden my resolve, put steel into my spine. I waited for the rush of outrage and strength to feel the power of it coalesce around me like a cloud. It never came. Just a hollow, fluttering sensation beneath my belt buckle. For a moment, I felt the fangs of the shadow demon from my dream once again. I started shaking. I looked around me. All around, the large courtyard was surrounded by high hedges, cut with crenellated squares, an imitation of castle walls. Trees rose up at the corners, trimmed to form the shapes of the guard towers. Small openings in the hedges led out into the darkness of the house grounds, but were closed with iron-barred doors. The only other way out I saw was at the head of the stairs, where Mavra leaned against the doors leading back into the manor and out front. She looked at me with those corpse-milk eyes, and her lips cracked as she gave me a small, chill smile. I gripped my cane with both hands. A sword cane, of course. One made in merry old Jack the Ripper, England, not a knockoff from one of those men's magazines that sells lava lamps and laser pointers, real steel. Clutching it didn't do much to make me feel better. I still shook. Reason. Reason was my next line of defense. Fear is bred from ignorance, so knowledge is a weapon against it, and reason is a tool of knowledge. I turned back to the front as Bianca started speaking to the crowd, some vainglorious bullshit I didn't pay any attention to. Reason. Facts. Fact one. Someone had engineered the uprising of the dead, the torment of the restless souls, most likely Mavra, had been the one to actually work the magic. The spiritual turbulence had also allowed the nightmare, the ghost of the demon Michael and I had slain, to cross over and come after me. Fact two, the nightmare was out to get me and Michael, personally, by taking shots at us and all of our friends. Mavra might even have been directing it, controlling it, using it as a cat's paw. Optionally, Bianca could have been learning from Mavra and used it herself. Either way, the results had been the same. Fact three, it hadn't come after us at sundown the way we'd half expected. Fact four, I was surrounded by monsters, with only the strength of a centuries-old tradition keeping them from tearing my throat out. Still, it seemed to be holding, for now, unless... Hell's bells, I swore. I hate it when I don't figure out the mystery, till it's too late. Dozens of gleaming red eyes turned toward me. Susan jabbed her elbow into my ribs. Shut up, Dresden, she hissed. You're making them look at us. Harry, Michael whispered. That's their game, I said quietly. We've been set up. Michael grunted. What? This whole thing, I said. The facts started falling into place about 2 hours too late. It's been a setup from the very beginning. The ghosts, the nightmare demon, the attacks on our family and friends, all of it. For what? Michael whispered. What's it a setup for? She meant to force us to show here from the very beginning. She's getting set to take a lesson from history, I said. We have to get out of here. A lesson from history? Michael said. Yeah. Remember what Vlad Tepes did at his inauguration? Oh, Lord, Michael breathed. Lord preserve us.
I don't get it, Susan said, voice quiet. What did this guy do?
He invited all of his political and personal enemies to a feast. Then he locked them in and burned them all alive. He wanted to start off his administration on a high note.
I see, Susan said.
And do you think this is what Bianca is doing? Lord preserve us, Michael murmured again. I'm told that he helps those who help themselves, I said. We've got to get out of here.
Michael's armor clinked as he looked around.
They've blocked the exits.
I know. How many of them can you handle without the sword?
If it was only a question of holding them off...
But it isn't. You may have to punch a hole through them.
Michael shook his head. I'm not sure. Maybe two or three, Lord willing. I grimaced. Only one vampire guarded each way out, but there were another two or three dozen in the courtyard, not to mention my godmother or any of the other guests, like Mavra.
We'll head for that gate, Michael said, nodding toward one of the gates in the hedges. I shook my head.
We'll never make it.
You will, he said. I think I can manage that much.
Ixnay on that oops day and play, I said. We need an idea that gets us all out alive.
No, Harry. I'm supposed to stand between people and the harm things like these offer, even if it kills me. It's my job.
You're supposed to have the sword with you. It's my fault that it's gone, so until I get it back for you, ease off the martyr throttle. I don't need anyone else on my conscience.
Or, I thought, a vengeful Charity coming after me for getting her children's father killed.
There's got to be a way out of this.
Let me get this straight, Susan said quietly, as Bianca's speech went on. We can't leave now because it would be an insult to the vampires. And all the excuse they would need to call for instant satisfaction.
Instant satisfaction, Susan said. What's that?
A duel to the death, which means that one of them would tear my arms off and watch me bleed to death, I said, if I'm lucky.
Susan swallowed.
I see.
And what happens if we just wait around?
Bianca or one of the others finds a way to make us cross the line and throw the first punch. Then they kill us.
And if we don't throw the first punch? Susan asked.
I figure she'll have a backup plan to wipe us out with, just in case.
Us? Susan asked.
I'm afraid so. I looked at Michael. We need a distraction, something that will get them all looking the other way.
He nodded and said, You might be better for that than me, Harry. I took a breath and looked around to see what I had to work with. We didn't have much time. Bianca was bringing her speech to a close.
And so, Bianca said, her voice carrying ably, we stand at the dawn of a new age for our kind, the first acknowledged court this far into the United States. No longer need we fear the wrath of our enemies. No longer we meekly bow our heads and offer our throats to those who claim power over us.
At this point, her dark eyes fastened directly upon me. "Finally, with the strength of the entire court behind us, with the lords of the outer night to empower us, we will face our enemies and bring them to their knees."
Her smile widened, curving fangs, blood red. She trailed a fingertip across her throat, then lifted the blood to her mouth to suckle it from her finger. She shivered.
"My dear subjects, tonight we have guests among us, guests brought here to witness our ascension to real power. Please, my friends, help me welcome them."
The spotlights swiveled around. One of them splashed onto my little group, me, Michael, Susan, with Thomas and Justine just a little apart. A second illuminated Mavra at the head of the stairs in all her stark and unearthly pallor. A third settled upon my godmother, who glowed with beauty in its light, casually tossing her hair back and casting a glittering smile around the courtyard. At my godmother's side was Mr. Farrow, unlit cigarette between his lips, smoke dribbling out his nostrils, looking martial and bland in his centurion gear and utterly unconcerned with everything that was going on. Applause, listless and somehow sinister, came out of the dark around us. There should be some kind of law. Anything that is so bad that its applause is sinister should be universally banned or something. Or maybe I was just that nervous. I coughed and waved my hand politely.
"The Red Court would like to take this opportunity to present our guests with gifts at this time," Bianca said, "so that they may know how very, very deeply we regard their goodwill. So, without further ado, Mr. Farrow, would you honor me by stepping forward and accepting this token of the goodwill of myself and my court?"
The spotlight followed Farrow as he walked forward. He reached the foot of the dais, inclined his head in a shallow but deliberate nod, then ascended to stand before Bianca. The vampire bowed to him in return and made a gesture with one hand. One of the hooded figures behind her stepped forward, holding a small cask about as big as a bread box. The figure opened it, and the lights gleamed on something that sparkled and shone. Pharaoh's eyes glittered, and he stretched his hand down into the cask, sinking it to the wrist. A small smile stretched his lips, and he withdrew his hand with slow reluctance. "A fine offering," he muttered, "especially in this age of paupers. I thank you." He and Bianca exchanged bows, where she dipped her head just a fraction lower than his own. Pharaoh closed the cask and took it beneath one arm, withdrawing a polite step before turning and descending the stairs. Bianca smiled and faced the courtyard again.
"Thomas of House Wraith, of our brothers and sisters in the White Court, please step forward, that I may give you a token of our regard."
I glanced over at Thomas. He took a slow breath and then said to me, "Would you stand with Justine for a while I'm up there?" I glanced at the girl. She stood looking up at Thomas, one hand on his arm, her eyes worried, one sweet little lip between her teeth. She looked small and young and frightened.
"Sure," I said.
I held out a rather stiff arm. The girl's hands clutched at my forearm as Thomas turned with a brilliant smile and swaggered into the spotlight and up the steps. She smelled delicious, like flowers or strawberries, with a low, heady, musky smell underneath, sensual and distracting.
"She hates him," Justine whispered, her fingers tightening on my arm, through my sleeve. "They all hate him."
I frowned and glanced down at the girl. Even worried, she was terribly beautiful, though her proximity to me lessened the impact of her outfit, or lack thereof. I focused on her face and said, "Why do they hate him?" She swallowed, then whispered,
"Lord Wraith is the highest lord of the White Court. Bianca extended her invitation to him. The lord sent Thomas in his stead. Thomas is his bastard son. Of the White Court, he is the lowest, the least regarded. His presence here is an insult to Bianca."
I got over my surprise that the girl had spoken that many words altogether. "Is there some kind of grudge between them?"
Justine nodded,
as on the dais Thomas and Bianca exchanged bows, she presented him with an envelope, speaking too quietly for the crowd to hear. He responded in kind. Justine said, "It's me. It's my fault. Bianca wanted me to come be hers, but Thomas found me first. She hasn't forgiven him for it. She calls him a poacher." Which made sense, in a way. Bianca had risen to where she was by being Chicago's most infamous madam. Her velvet room provided the services of girls most men only got to daydream about, for a hefty price. She had enough dirt and political connections that she could protect herself from legal prosecution, even without counting any of her vampire tricks, and she'd always had more than her share of those. Bianca would want someone like Justine. Sweet-looking, gorgeous, unconsciously sexy. Probably dress her up in a plaid skirt and a starched white shirt with down hairy hell's bells. "Is that why you stay with him?" I asked her. "Because you feel it's your fault he has enemies?" She looked up at me for a moment, then away, her expression more sad than anything. "You wouldn't understand. Look, he's a vampire. I know that they can affect people, but you could be in danger. I don't need rescuing, Mr. Dresden," she said. Her lovely eyes sparkled with something hard, determined. "But there's something you can do for me." I got an edgy feeling and watched the girl warily. "Yeah? Like what?" "You can take Thomas and me with you when you leave." "You guys showed up in a limo, and you want to ride home with me?" "Don't be coy, Mr. Dresden," she said. "I know what you and your friends were talking about." I felt my shoulders creak with tension. "You heard us? You aren't human either." "I'm very human, Mr. Dresden, but I read lips. Will you help him or not?" "It isn't my business to protect him." Her soft mouth compressed into a hard line. "I'm making it your business." "Are you threatening me?" Her face flushed as pink as the dress she was almost wearing, but she stood her ground. "We need friends, Mr. Dresden. If you won't help us, then I'll try to buy Bianca's favor by exposing your plans to escape and claiming that I heard you talking about killing her." "That's a lie," I hissed. "It's an exaggeration," she said, her voice gentle. She lowered her eyes. "But it will be enough for her to call a duel, or to force you to shed blood. And if that happens, you will die." She took a breath. "I don't want it to be like that. But if we don't do something to protect ourselves, she'll kill him and make me into one of her pet whores." "I wouldn't let that happen to you," I said. The words poured out of my mouth before I'd had time to run them past the thinking part of my brain. But they had that solid, certain ring of truth. Oh, hell. She looked up at me, uncertain again, catching one of those soft lips between her teeth. "Really?" she whispered. "You really mean that, don't you?" I grimaced. Yeah, I guess I do." "Then you'll help me. You'll help us." Michael, Susan, Justine, Thomas. Before long, I was going to need a secretary just to keep track of everyone I was supposed to be looking out for. "You, but Thomas can look out for himself." Justine's eyes filled with tears. "Mr. Dresden, please. If there's anything I can do or say to convince you, I..." "Damn it," I swore, earning a glare from Michael. Damn it, woman. All women, for that matter. That earned me a glare from Susan. "He's a vampire, Justine. He's eating you. Why should you care if something happens to him?" "He's also a person, Mr. Dresden," Justine said. "A person who's never done you any harm. Why shouldn't you care what happens to him?" I hate it when a woman asks me for help and I witlessly decide to go ahead and give it, regardless of dozens of perfectly good reasons not to. I hate it when I get threatened and strong-armed into doing something stupid and risky. I hate it when someone takes a moral high ground on me and wins. Justine had just done all three, and I couldn't hold it against her. She just looked too sweet and helpless. "All right," I said, against my better judgment. "All right, just stay close. You want my protection? Then do what I say, when I say, and maybe we can all get out of this alive." She let out a little shudder that ran through her most attractively, and then she pressed herself against me. "Thank you," she murmured, nuzzling her face into the hollow of my throat, so that little lightning streaks of sensation flickered down my spine. Thank you, Mr. Dresden. I coughed uncomfortably and firmly shoved back any ideas of extracting a more thorough thanks from her later, despite the clamoring of my sex drive. Probably the vampire venom, I reasoned, making me notice things like that even more. Sure. I pushed Justine gently away and looked up to see Thomas returning from his visit to the dais, holding an envelope in his hand. Well, I greeted him quietly as he returned. That looks like it went well enough. He gave me a rather pallid smile. She can be rather frightening when she wishes, can't she? Don't let her get to you, I advised him. What did she give you? Thomas accepted Justine into the circle of his arm, and she pressed her body to his as though she wanted to wallow in him and leave one of those angel shapes. He lifted the envelope and said, a condo in Hawaii, and a ticket there, on a late flight tonight. She suggested that I might want to leave Chicago, permanently. One ticket, I said, and glanced at Justine. Friendly of her, I commented. Look, Thomas, we both want to get out of here tonight. Just stay close to me and follow my lead, all right? He frowned a bit and then shot Justine a reproachful look. Justine, I asked you not to.
I had to, she said, her face earnest, frightened. I had to do something to help you.
He coughed. I apologize, Mr. Dresden. I didn't want to involve anyone else in my problems. I rubbed at the back of my neck. It's okay. We can help each other, I guess. Thomas closed his eyes for a moment. Then he said very simply and very openly, thank you.
Sheesh,
I said. I glanced up at Bianca, who was in converse with one of the robed and hooded shadows. The pair of them vanished to the back of the dais while Bianca watched, and then returned, lugging something that evidently weighed a good deal. They settled the fairly large object, hidden beneath a dark red cloth, on the dais beside Bianca.
Harry Dresden, Bianca purred. Old and esteemed acquaintance, and wizard of the White Council. Please come forward so that I can give you some of what I've been longing to for so long.
I gulped and shot a glance back at Michael and Susan. Look sharp, I said. If she's going to do something, I guess it will be now, when we're separated. He put his hand on her shoulder and said, God go with you, Harry. Energy thrummed along my skin, and the nearest vampire shifted about uneasily and took a few steps away. He saw me notice and gave me a small, sheepish smile.
Be careful, Mr. Dresden, Susan said.
I bobbed my eyebrows at them, nodded to Thomas and Justine, then walked forward, my cane in one hand, my cheesy cape flowing in the night air as I mounted the stairs to the dais. A bit of sweat stung the corner of my eye, smearing my makeup, probably. I ignored it, meeting Bianca's gaze as I came level with her. Vampires don't have souls. She didn't fear my gaze, and she wasn't good enough to sucker me into hers. Or at least, she hadn't been a couple of years ago. She met my gaze steady, her eyes dark and lovely, and so very, very deep. I took the better course of valor and focused upon the tip of her perfectly upturned nose. I saw her breast rise and fall in pleasure beneath the flames that gowned her, and she let out a small, purring sound of satisfaction.
Oh, Harry Dresden, I had looked forward to seeing you tonight. You are a very handsome man, after all, but you look utterly ridiculous.
Thanks, I said. No one, except maybe a pair of robed attendants at the back of the dais, could hear us. How'd you plan on killing me? She fell quiet for a moment, thoughtful. Then she asked me, as she formally inclined her head for the benefit of the crowd below, do you remember Paula, Mr. Dresden? I returned the gesture, only more shallowly, just to throw a little zing of insult into it. I remember. She was pretty, polite. I didn't really get to meet her much.
No. She was dead within an hour of you setting foot in my house.
I thought she might have gotten that way, I said. That you might have killed her, you mean? It isn't my fault if you lost control and ate her, Bianca. She smiled, teeth blinding white.
Oh, it was your fault, Mr. Dresden. You'd come to my house, provoked me to near madness, forced me to go along with you under threat of my destruction.
She leaned forward, giving me a glimpse down the flame dress she was naked beneath.
Now I get to return the favor. I'm not someone you can simply walk over, slap around whenever you have a need. Not anymore.
She paused and then said,
In a way, I'm grateful to you, Dresden. If I hadn't wanted so very badly to kill you, I would never have amassed the power and the contacts that I have. I never would have been elevated to the court.
She gestured to the crowd of vampires below, the courtyard, the darkness.
In a way, all of this is your doing.
That's a lie, I said, quiet. I didn't make you rope Mavra into working for you. I didn't make you order her to torture those poor ghosts, stir up the Never-Never, and bring Kravos's pet demon back across to send after a bunch of innocents while you tried to get me.
Her smile widened. Is that what you think happened? Oh, my, Mr. Dresden, you have an unpleasant surprise awaiting you.
Anger made me lift my eyes to meet her gaze. Gave me the strength not to get pulled in by it. No mistaking. She had grown stronger in the last couple of years.
Can we just get this over with?
Anything worth doing is worth doing slowly, she murmured. But she reached out a hand and tugged on the dark red cloth, uncovering the object there.
For you, Mr. Dresden, with all of my most fervent sincerities.
The cloth slid away from a white marble tombstone, set with a pentacle of gold in its center. Block letters carved into it read, Here lies Harry Dresden, above the pentacle. Below it, they read, He died doing the right thing. An envelope had been taped to the side of the tombstone.
Do you like it? Bianca purred.
It comes complete with your own plot at Graceland, near to your dear little Inez. I'm sure you'll have ever so much to talk about when your time comes, of course. I looked from the tombstone back up at her.
Go ahead, I said. Make your move.
She laughed, a rich sound that spilled back down into the crowd below.
Oh, Mr. Dresden, she said, lowering her voice.
You really don't understand, do you? I can't openly strike you down, regardless of what you may have done to me. But I can defend myself. I can stand by while my guests defend themselves. I can watch you die. And if things are hectic and confusing enough, a few others die along with you. Well, that's hardly to be blamed upon me.
Thomas, I said,
and his little whore, and the knight, and your reporter friend. I'm going to enjoy the rest of the evening, Harry.
My friends call me Harry, I said, not you.
She smiled and said, Revenge is like sex, Mr. Dresden. It's best when it comes on slow, quiet, until it all seems inexorable.
You know what they say about revenge? I hope you got a second tombstone, Bianca, for the other grave.
My words stung her, and she stiffened. Then she beckoned the attendants forward to lift my tombstone in their gloved hands and carry it back.
I'll have it delivered to Graceland, Mr. Dresden. They'll have your bed all ready for you before the sun rises.
She flicked her wrist at me, curt dismissal.
I bowed my head, a bare, stark motion, cold. We'll see.
How's that for a comeback?
I turned and descended the stairs, my legs shaking a little, my back rigid and straight.
Harry, Michael said as I drew close, what happened?
And I held up my hand and shook my head, trying to think. The trap was already closing around me. I could feel that much. But if I could figure out Bianca's plan, see it coming, maybe I could think my way out of it ahead of her. I trusted Michael and the others to keep an eye out for trouble while I furiously pondered, tried to work out through Bianca's logic.
My godmother glided forward at Bianca's bidding, and I paused for a moment to glance up at the dais. Bianca presented her with a small black case. Leah opened it, and a slow tremble ran down her body, made her flame-red hair shift and glisten. My godmother closed it again and said, "A princely gift. Happily, as is the custom of my people, I have brought a matter of equal worth to exchange with you." Leah beckoned the attendant forward and was given a long, dark case. She opened it, displaying it for a moment to Bianca, and then turned, showing it to the gathered court. Amaracus, Michael's sword. It lay gleaming in the dark box, casting back the ruddy light with a pure, argent radiance. Michael went stiff beside me, stifling a shout. A murmur went up from the assembled vampires and sundry creatures. They recognized the sword as well. Leah basked in it for a moment until she folded the case closed and passed it over to Bianca. Bianca settled it across her lap and smiled down at me, and I thought at Michael. "A worthy reply to my gift," Bianca said. "I thank you, Lady Lianchi. May Mavra of the Black Court come forward." My godmother retreated. Mavra glided out of the night and onto the dais. "Mavra, you have been a most gracious and honorable guest in my house," Bianca said, "and I trust that you have found your treatment here fair and equitable." Mavra bowed to Bianca, silent, her rheumy eyes gleaming, glancing down toward Michael. "Oh, Jesus," I whispered, "son of a bitch." "He didn't mean it, Lord," Michael said. "Harry, what did you mean?" I clenched my teeth, eyes flickering around. Everyone was watching me. All the vampires, Mr. Farrow, everyone. They all knew what was coming. The tombstone. It was written on my damn tombstone. Bianca watched the realization come over me, still smiling. "Then please, Mavra, accept these minor tokens of my goodwill, and with them my hopes that vengeance and prosperity will belong to you and yours." She offered forth the case containing the sword, which Mavra accepted. Bianca then beckoned to the background, and the attendants brought out another covered bundle. The attendants jerked the cover off the bundle. Lydia. Her dark, tousled hair had been trimmed into an elegant cut. She wore a halter and shorts of black lycra that emphasized her hips, the beauty of her pale limbs. Her eyes stared into the lights, glazed, drugged, and she sagged helplessly between the attendants. "My God," Susan said. "What are they going to do with that girl?" Mavra turned to Lydia, reaching into the case as she did. "Sweet," her hissing voice rasped. Her eyes went to Michael again. "Now to open my gift. It may tarnish the steel a bit, but I'm sure I'll get over it." Michael drew in a sudden breath. "What's going on?" Susan blurted. "The blood of innocence," he snarled. "The sword is vulnerable. She means to unmake it. Harry, we cannot allow it." All around me, vampires dropped their wineglasses, slid out of their jackets, bared their scarlet-smeared fangs in slow smiles to me. Bianca started laughing up above me as Mavra opened the case and withdrew Amaracus. The sword seemed to almost chime with an angry sound as the vampire touched it, but Mavra only sneered down at the blade as she lifted the sword. Thomas moved closer to us, pushing Justine behind him as he drew his sword. "Dresden," he hissed. "Dresden, don't be a fool. There's only one life, one girl's life, and a sword balanced against all of us. If you act now, you condemn us all." "Harry," Susan said, her voice shaking. Michael, too, turned to look at me, his expression grim. "Faith, Dresden, not all is lost." All looked pretty damn lost to me, but I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to lift a finger. All I had to do to get out of here alive was to sit still, to do nothing. All I had to do was stand here and watch while they murdered a girl who had come to me a few days before, begging for my protection. All I had to do was ignore her screams as Mavra gutted her. All I had to do was let the monsters destroy one of the major bastions standing against them. All I had to do was let Michael go to his death, claim the protection of the laws of hospitality upon Susan, and I could walk away. Michael nodded at me, then drew both knives and turned toward the dais. I closed my eyes. God forgive me for what I'm about to do. I grabbed Michael's shoulder before he could start walking. Then I drew the sword blade forth from the cane, holding the cane in my left hand, reversing it in my grip as I drew in my will, sending it coursing down the shaft of the cane, causing blue-white light to flare in the ruins etched there. Michael flashed me a fighting grin and took position at my right. Thomas took one look at me and whispered, "We're dead." But he fell in at my left, crystalline sword glittering in his hand. A howl went up from the vampires, a sudden wave of deafening sound. Mavra turned her eyes to us, gathering night into the fingers of her free hand again. Bianca slowly rose, dark eyes glowing in triumph. Over to one side, Leah laid her hand on Mr. Farrow's arm, frowning faintly, standing well out of the way. Mavra hissed, lifting Amarakis up high.
"Harry," Susan said, her shaking hand touched my shoulder. "What are we going to do?"
"Stay behind me, Susan," I clenched my teeth. "I guess I'm going to do the right thing. Even if it kills me," I thought. "And all of you, too."
Chapter 30. In games and history books and military science lectures, teachers and old warhorses and other scholarly types lay out diagrams and stand up models in neat lines and rows. They show you, in a methodical order, how this division forced a hole in that line, or how these troops held their ground while all others broke. But that's an illusion. A real struggle between combatants, whether they number dozens or thousands, is something inherently messy, fluid, difficult to follow. The illusion can show you the outcome, but it doesn't impress upon you the surge and press of bodies, the screams, the fear, the faltering rushes forward or away. Within the battle, everything is wild motion and sound and a blur of impressions that flash by almost before they have time to register. Instinct and reflex rule everything. There isn't time to think. And if there's a spare second or two, the only thought in your head is, "How do I stay alive?" You're instantly aware of what's happening around you. It's an obscure kind of torture, an acute and temporary hell. Because one way or another, it doesn't last long. A tide of vampires came toward us. They rushed in, animal swift, a blur of twisted, bulging faces and staring black eyes. Their jaws hung too far open, fangs bared, hissing and howling. One of them held a long spear and shoved it toward Thomas's pale belly. Justine screamed. Thomas swept the crystalline sword he bore down in an arc, parrying the spear's tip aside and cutting through the shaft. Undeterred, the spear-wielding vampire came on and sank its fangs into Thomas's forearm. Thomas shoved the vamp back, but it held firm. Thomas switched tactics, abruptly lifting the vampire up and clear off the ground, and then rolled the sword's blade around its belly, splitting it open in a welter of gore. The vampire fell to the ground, a sound bubbling up from its throat, and was one part fury and one part agony. "Their bellies!" Thomas shouted. "Without the blood, they're too weak to fight!" Michael caught a descending machete blade on the metal guard of his forearm and whipped one of his knives across the belly of the vamp who held it. Blood spattered out of the vamp, and it went down in convulsions. "I know!" Michael snapped back, flashing Thomas an irritated look. And then he was buried in a swarm of red-clad bodies. "Michael!" I shouted. I tried to push toward him, but I found myself jostled aside. I saw him struggle and drop to one knee, saw the vampire shoving knives at him, and fangs, teeth tearing and worrying, and if any of them were burning like before, I couldn't see it. Kyle Hamilton appeared across the dog pile over the fallen knight. He bared his fangs at me and lifted a semi-automatic, one of the expensive models, gold-plated. "Fare thee well, Dresden." I lifted the cane, its ruins shimmering blue and white, and snapped, "Venti Ferro!" The magic whispered silently out through the runes on the cane.
Earth magic isn't really my forte, but I like to keep my hand in. The ruins and the power I willed into the staff reached out and caught the gun in invisible waves of magnetism. I had been worried that the spells I'd laid on the cane might have gone stale, but they were still hanging in there. The gun flew from Kyle's hands. I whipped it through the air, into the face of another vamp coming toward Justine. It hit at something just this side of the speed of sound and sent the thing flying back into the darkness. Justine whirled as the second vampire came at her, only to have its legs literally scythed out from beneath it by Thomas's blade.
Jesu Domine!
Michael's voice rang out from beneath the vampires like a brass army bugle, and with a sudden explosion of pressure and unseen force, bodies flew back and up, away from him, flesh ripped and torn from them, hanging and ragged, bloodless strips like cloth, showing gleaming, oily black flesh underneath.
Domine!
Michael shouted, rising, slewing gutted vamps off him like a dog sheds off water.
Lava! Quod esorium!
Come on, I called, and strode forward, toward the steps leading up to the dais. Michael had parted the scarlet sea, as it were. Stunned vampires gathered themselves from the ground, or slowed their attack, hovering several feet away, hissing. Susan and Justine caught one of them starting to creep in closer, and discouraged the others from following its example by splattering it with holy water from Susan's basket. The thing howled and fell back, clawing at its eyes, flopping and wriggling like a half-crushed bug.
Bianca!
Thomas shouted.
Our only chance is to take out their leader!
A knife flew out from the dark, too fast for me to see, but Thomas did. He reached out and flicked the blade of his sword across its path with a contemptuous swat, deflecting it out. We reached the foot of the stairs.
Thomas, hold them here. Michael, we go up.
I didn't wait to see who was listening. I just turned and headed up the stairs, sword and cane out, ready, my stomach sinking. There was no way we would be in time to save Lydia. But we were. The carnage had evidently drawn Mauver's attention, and she stared at the blood, withered lips pulling back from yellow teeth. She looked at me, her expression twisted in malice. She spun back to Lydia, sword held high.
Michael,
I snapped, and stretched out my cane.
Then to Pharaoh!
Amarakis burst into conflicting shades of blue and golden light. As my power wrapped around it, a coruscation of sparks that made Mauver howl in surprise and pain. The vampire retreated, but kept her pale hands clenched on the blade.
Suit yourself, Sparky,
I muttered. I gritted my teeth as the cane smoked and shook in my hand.
Vente! Vente, Pharaoh!
I whipped the cane in a wide arc, and with a hiss the vampire found herself lifted clear off the ground by the grip on the sword, and flung like a beach ball toward the courtyard below. She smacked into the stones of the courtyard hard, brittle, popping sounds as gruesome accompaniment. The sword exploded in another cloud of vengeful, ardent sparks and went spinning away from Mauver, the blade flashing where it hit the ground. A wave of exhaustion and dizziness swept over me, and I nearly fell. Even using a focus, the ruin-etched cane, that effort had nearly been more than I could manage. I had to clench my teeth and hope I wouldn't simply pitch to one side. I was getting down to the bottom of the barrel, as far as magic went.
Harry, Michael shouted, look out!
I looked up to see Mauver bound up onto the dais again, not bothering to take the stairs, landing a few feet from me. Michael strode forward, one hand holding a dagger up reversed, pointing down, a cross extended toward Mauver. The vampire flung her hands at Michael, and darkness spilled out of them like oil, splattering toward the knight. It sizzled and spat against him, going up in puffs of steam, and Michael came on forward through it. White fire gathered up around the upheld cross. Mauver let out a dusty, hissing scream and fell back from him, forced away from me.
Harry,
Thomas shouted from up the stairs.
Hurry up! We can't last much longer!
My eyes swept the dais, but I could see no sign of Bianca or her attendants in the shadows cast by the halogen brightness of Michael's blazing cross. I hurried to Lydia, sheathing my slender blade before scooping her up.
Longer. I'm amazed we're still alive now. Light shines brightest in the deepest dark,
Michael shouted, a fierce joy on his face, his eyes alight with a passion and a vengeance I had never seen in him. He kept forcing Mavra back before the paralyzing fire of the cross, until with a scream she fell from the dais.
"Let come the forces of night. We will stand."
"We will get the hell out of here is what we'll do," I muttered, but louder I said.
"Back, down the stairs. Let's go."
I turned to see Thomas, Susan, and Justine holding off a ring of vampires at the base of the stairs to the dais between a pair of spotlights. Only scraps of skin and cloth clung to the vampires. Some of the red court still had partially human faces, but most stood naked now, free of the flesh masks they wore. Black, flabby creatures, twisted, horrible faces, bellies bulging, mostly tight with fresh blood. Black eyes, empty of anything but hunger, glittered in the night. Long, skinny fingers ended in black claws, as did the grasping toes of their feet, membranes stretched between their arms and flanks. Horribly slime-covered, the beautiful bodies and shapes of before give way to the horror beneath. A vampire lurched toward Thomas, while another reached out to grasp Susan. She thrust her cross in its face, but unlike Mavra, the wood did not blaze to light. Faith magic isn't always easy to work, even on vampires. In the Red Court, creatures with a more solid hold on reality than the more magical denizens of the Black were not so easily repelled. The vampire howled, mouth yawning open, foaming slaver splattering Susan's red hood. She twisted and fought, and with her other hand swept up another baby food jar of holy water, and not at the vampire, but at the spotlight beside them. With a screaming hiss, the water vaporized against the heat of the light, bursting out in a sudden cloud of steam that enfolded the vampire completely. It let out a screech that swept up toward the range of human hearing, vanishing above it and fell away before Susan, its skin sloughing off, the black stringy muscles and bones beneath showing through. Susan fumbled her basket open and drew her gun. She fired for the vampire's belly, the rapid thump-thump-thump of panic fire, and the vampire's abdomen ruptured, blood spraying out in a cloud. The vamp fell to the ground, and I remember thinking that she'd just killed the thing, really and truly taken out one of them. A fierce pride shot through me, and I headed down the stairs. And then our streak of luck ended. Justine took a step too far to one side, and Bianca appeared out of nowhere, seizing the girl by the hair and dragging her away from Thomas. Thomas whirled, but too late. Bianca held the girl's back against her front, her fingers wound with deceptive gentleness around Justine's throat. With the other hand, Bianca, still quite human-seeming and calm, caressed the girl's belly. Justine struggled, but Bianca simply turned her head to one side and drew her tongue slowly, sensuously over Justine's throat. The girl's eyes widened, panicked. Then they grew heavy. She shuddered, her body relaxing toward Bianca, arching slowly. Bianca's rich mouth quirked, and she murmured something into Justine's ear that made the girl whimper. "Enough," Bianca said, and as quickly as that, the courtyard grew silent. Michael and I stood on the stairs a bit above Thomas and Susan. The vampires ringed them in, just out of reach of Thomas's sword. I held Lydia unmoving in my arms. Bianca looked up at me and said, "The game has ended, wizard."
"You haven't taken us down yet," I shot back. "Smart for you and your people to get out of my way before I get cranky."
Bianca laughed, idly plucking some of the petals from Justine's top, baring a little more of her breasts.
"Surely you don't think me so stupid as to be bluffed now, Dresden. You have already had a measure of your strength taken. What remains barely keeps you standing. If you could force your way out, you would have done it already."
Her eyes moved to Michael.
"And you, Sir Knight, you will die gloriously and take many of the horrid creatures of the night with you. But you are outnumbered and alone and without the sword. You will die."
I glanced at Thomas and Susan and said,
"Well then, I guess it's a good thing we brought help. Your whole court, Bianca, and you couldn't take us down."
I swept my eyes back and forth over the vampires below and said,
"All of your little minions here have eternity laid out before them. Eternity is a bad thing to lose. And maybe you would get us, eventually. But whichever of you would like to lose eternity first, please, just go ahead and step on up."
Silence reigned over the courtyard for a moment. I allowed a bit of hope to seep into my pounding heart. Kenny Rogers, eat your heart out. If this bluff worked, I'd be more of a gambler than he'd ever dreamed. Bianca only smiled and said to Thomas,
"She's so beautiful, my cousin of the White Court. I've wanted her ever since the moment I saw her."
Bianca licked her lips.
"What would you say to a bargain?"
I sneered. "You think we would do business with you?" Thomas glanced back up at me. Incredibly, he was clean, but for a sprinkling of scarlet droplets on his pale flesh, unmarred, loincloth, wings, and all.
"Go ahead," he said. "I'm listening."
"Give them to us, Thomas Wraith," Bianca said. "Give us these three, and take this girl as your own, uncontested. I will have as many little pets as I wish now. What is one over another?"
"Thomas," I said, "I know we just met, but don't listen to her. She set you up to get killed already."
Thomas glanced back and forth between us. He met my eyes for a moment, almost long enough to let me see inside him, and then looked away. I had the impression that he was trying to tell me something. I don't know what. His expression seemed apologetic, maybe. "I know, Mr. Dresden," he said, "but I'm afraid the situation has changed." He didn't kick Susan so much as he simply planted his sandal foot against her and shoved her into the crowd of vampires. She let out a short, startled scream, and then they took her and dragged her into the darkness. Thomas lowered his sword and turned toward me, his back to the vampires. Leering, hissing, they crept closer to Michael and me, around Thomas, one of them rubbing up against his legs. His mouth twisted in distaste, and he sidestepped.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Dresden. Harry, I do like you quite a bit, but I'm afraid that I like myself a whole lot more."
Thomas faded back, while the vampires crowded around the bottom of the stairs. Somewhere in the dark, Susan let out a short, terrified scream, and then it faded to a moan, and then silence. Bianca smiled sweetly at me over Justine's lolling head.
"And so, wizard, it ends. The pair of you will die, but don't worry. No one will ever find the bodies."
She glanced back toward where Thomas had faded into the background and said aside,
"Kyle, Mauvra, kill the white-bellied little bastard, too."
Thomas's head whipped around toward Bianca, and he snarled,
"You bitch!"
My mouth worked and twisted, but no words came out. How could they? Words couldn't possibly contain the frustration, the rage, the fear that poured through me. It cut through my weariness, sharp as thorns and barbed wire. It wasn't fair. We'd done everything we could. We'd risked everything. Not we. The choices had been mine. I'd risked everything. And I'd lost. Michael and I couldn't possibly fight them all alone. They'd taken Susan. The help we thought we'd found had turned against us. They had Susan. And it was my fault. I hadn't listened to her when I should have. I hadn't protected her. And now she was going to die because of me. I don't know how that realization would make someone else feel. I don't know if the despair, the self-loathing, and the helpless fury would crumble them like too brittle concrete, or melt them like dirty lead, or shatter them like cheap glass. I only know what it did to me. It set me on fire. Fire in my heart, in my thoughts, in my eyes. I burned. Burned down deep in my gut, burned in places I hadn't known I could hurt. I don't remember the spell or the words I said, but I remember reaching for that pain. I remember reaching for it and thinking that if we had to go, then so God help me, weakened or not, hopeless or not, I was going to take these murdering, blood-sucking son-of-a-bitches with me. I would show them that they couldn't play lightly with the powers of creation, of life itself, that it wasn't smart to cross a wizard of the White Council when someone has stolen his girlfriend. I think Michael must have sensed something and taken the girl from my arms, because the next thing I remember is thrusting my hands toward the night sky and screaming,
"Fuego! Paro fuego!
Burn, you greasy, bat-faced bastards, burn! I reached for the fire, and fire answered me. The tree towers of the topiary castle exploded into blazes of light, and the hedge walls, complete with their crenellated tops, went up with them. Fire leapt up into the air, 40, 50 feet, and the sudden explosion of it lifted everyone but me up and off the ground, set wind roaring around us in a gale. I stood amidst it, my mind brilliantly lit by the power coursing through me. It burned me, and part of me screamed out in joy that it did. My cloak flapped and danced in the gale, spreading out around me in a scarlet and sable cloud. The abrupt glare fell on the scene of the vampire's revelry, lighting it harshly. The young people of earlier lay about in the darkness, near the hedges, near the fires, pathetic little lumps. Some of them twitched, some of them breathed. A few of them whimpered and tried to crawl away from the heat, but most lay dreadfully, perfectly still. Pale. Pretty. Dead. The fury in me grew. It swelled and burned, and I reached out to the fires again. Flames flew out, caught one of the more cowardly of the vampires, huddled at the back, scrabbling to slip his flesh mask back over his squashed bat face. The fire touched him, and then twined about him, searing and blackening his skin, then dragging him back, winding and rolling him toward the blaze. The magic danced in my eyes, my head, my chest, flying wild and out of control. I couldn't follow everything that happened. More vampires got too close to the flames and began screaming. Tendrils of fire rose up from the ground and began to slither over the courtyard like serpents. Everything exploded into motion, shadows flashing through the brightness, seeking escape, screaming. I felt my heart clench in my chest and stop beating. I swayed on my feet, gasping. Michael got to me, Lydia slung over his shoulder in a fireman's carry. He'd torn his cloak off and lay it to one side, burning. He dragged my arm across his shoulder and half carried me down the stairs. Smoke gathered on us, thick and choking. I coughed and retched, helpless. The magic coursed through me, slower now, a trickle. Not because the floodgates had closed, but because I had nothing left to pour out. I hurt. Fire spread out from my heart, my arms and legs clenched and twitching. I couldn't get a breath, couldn't think, and I knew, somewhere amidst all that pain, that I was about to die. "Lord," Michael coughed, "Lord, I know that Harry hasn't always done what you would have done," he staggered forward, carrying me and the girl, "but he's a good man. He's fought against your foes. He deserves better than to die here, Lord. So if you could be kind enough to show me how to get us out of here, I'd really appreciate it." And then, abruptly, the smoke parted, and sweet, untainted air hit us in the face like a bucket of ice water. I fell to the ground. Michael dropped the girl somewhere near me and tore the cheap tuxedo open. He laid his hand over my heart and let out a short cry. After that, I don't remember much more than pain and a series of dull, hard thumps on my chest. And then my heart lurched and began to beat again. The red haze of agony receded. I looked up. The smoke had parted in a tunnel, as though someone had shoved a glass tube of clean air through it and around us. At the far end of the tunnel stood a slender, willowy figure, tall, feminine. Something like wings spread out behind the figure, though that might have been an illusion, light falling on it from many angles, so that it was all shadow and color. "I thought he wasn't so literal," I choked. Michael drew back from me, his soot-stained face breaking into a brief smile. "Are you complaining?" "Heck no. Where's Susan?" "I'll come back in for her. Come on." Too tired to argue, I let him haul me back to my feet. He picked up Lydia, and we staggered forward and out to the figure at the tunnel's far end. Leah, my fairy godmother. We both drew up short. Michael fumbled for his knife, but it was gone. Leah quirked one delicate brow at us. Her dress, still blue, unsoiled, flowed around her, and her silken mane matched the bloody fires consuming the courtyard. She looked almost